I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. One of the many things that makes our region special is our proximity to salt water. For those who make a living on the water or enjoy recreational or sporting activities, the Cape Coast and Islands gives unparalleled opportunities. Yet anyone who has spent time on the water knows that it can be unpredictable, inhospitable, and dangerous. On land, help is a 911 call away. On the water, whether you're offshore 200 miles or sailing Nantucket Sound, it's the United States Coast Guard who answers the call. Although the Coast Guard has a multi-pronged mission, search and rescue is perhaps their most high-profile job. We are fortunate to have a Coast Guard air station right here on Cape Cod, so we decided to get a closer look at what it takes for the Coast Guard to live up to their motto, always ready. On a cold day in March, producer Amy Vince and I spent the day with a Coast Guard air crew and went along on their rescue training exercise. Our visit began with the operations officer at Coast Guard Air Station, Commander Peter Evanock, who is also a fixed-wing pilot. We started by asking him the geographic area Air Station Cape Cod covers.
The area of responsibility for us here at Cape Cod, we cover across five states. So we're all the way from essentially New York City up to the border with Maine and Canada.
And what type of aircraft do you use?
So we have two different types of aircraft. We have our helicopter is the H-60 Jayhawk, and we also have a fixed-wing asset, which is the HC-144 Ocean Sentry. It's a CASA 235 aircraft.
And that's what you fly?
That's what I fly, correct.
Tell us the difference when you would choose to use the Jayhawk versus the CASA.
What makes the helicopter unique for the maritime environment for us is the hoist capability. So when you're actually going to go out and, you know, pluck somebody out of the water or off of a vessel for like a medevac mission, you're going to use the helicopter for that, for the search and rescue side. We also use them for patrols as well for maritime law enforcement, living marine resources, and the other mission set that we do in the Coast Guard. The fixed-wing asset is search and rescue as well. It can't, you know, actually affect the rescue like the helicopter can, but it's got longer range than the helicopter has, so it can go farther offshore, and we can deploy life rafts, dewatering pumps, radio cans, other survival gear to people that are in the water, and then we can vector in the helicopter or a surface asset to come pick up those individuals.
Talk about the importance of the training exercises.
So certainly this is a skill set that will diminish if you don't practice it frequently. So we go out routinely and practice this skill set so that we stay proficient. And then also as individuals progress in their career, they'll upgrade to higher levels of qualification in the aircraft. So we go out and do those training exercises to upgrade personnel and to maintain proficient in our current skill set.
And you go out in some pretty scary weather, I must say. Does the weather ever get to a point that you won't or cannot go out?
So that is our job, right? So it is the Coast Guard. We're to go, you know, rescue people in distress in bad weather. You know, I guess to say if the weather is too bad, I guess I would say it probably depend on the level of the strength of, like, you know, the hurricane force winds. You know, like, is it overpowering for the aircraft? Up here in the Northeast, icing conditions are a common occurrence for us. Severe icing is something that the aircraft can't handle, and essentially that means the de-ice, anti-ice systems on the aircraft are being overpowered by the icing conditions. So if it was so bad that our systems couldn't keep up with it, then we'd have to, you know, extricate ourselves from that mission in order to, you know, preserve the aircraft and our own lives if it was so bad. But I would say for the most part, we have very capable aircraft. We have very capable crew members that fly them, and we can pretty much go out and some pretty dangerous, pretty scary stuff.
What about nighttime? Is that when that infrared stuff comes in handy?
Correct. So for the nighttime missions, the pilots and air crew have night vision goggles that they wear, and then the aircraft do have the sensors on them. So they have the infrared, cameras that can pick up the heat signatures. You know, you'll be able to see a person in the water or a vessel at night, you know, off that contrast from the heat signature that's being put off by it.
Your most memorable experience?
Most memorable experience operationally in the organization is probably when I was stationed in North Carolina. There was a subtropical hurricane that had kind of spun up kind of out of nowhere. Like, they really weren't predicting it. And there were four sailboats that actually went down this day. All four of them had three individuals on it. We were able to effect a rescue of three of the four. One of the sailboats was never found ever again. No one ever found it, no matter, you know, the amount of search effort we put into it. And that was probably, like, worst weather I've ever flown in, and it was a considerable effort that the organization put out for those sailboats to get the people off those that day. So that was, I'd say, kind of memorable moment on that one.
Jen Irving has her own memorable rescue experience and a great appreciation for the Coast Guard's skill and willingness to fly in severe weather. More than 25 years ago, she was one of nine crew aboard the Anna Christina, a 105-year-old three-masted schooner that ran into trouble on a transit from New York to Bermuda. She shares her story with producer Amy Vince.
The tools that you had to get your weather were less sophisticated. And so at that point, we had a single sideband radio for which we received weather faxes. And that, I want to say, only came in. You could either get your weather faxes or your information via the single sideband radio every 6 hours. And so we regularly listened to that every 6 hours. And at one point, a couple days into our journey, we heard word of a tropical depression that was forming east of Bermuda. And that sort of raised the red flag for us. And we were concerned because of the natural course of events is for a tropical depression can escalate up into a hurricane.
These events were taking place in October of 1991. The tropical depression east of Bermuda did turn into a hurricane, Hurricane Grace, which combined with a nor'easter and created a massive and powerful weather system that we now refer to as the perfect storm.
So as soon as we got word that there was a tropical depression, we actually changed our path from sort of a line to Bermuda to start working our way back toward the coast. You know, it was an old boat from the 1800s, and she had wooden hull with caulking and seams, and we were, you know, the seams work in the sort of weather condition, and it's not uncommon to lose some of the caulking or to take on water through the hull in a wooden boat. And so, you know, initially as we got into heavier seas and heavier winds, we were, you know, manning more pumps. But then it came to the point where we had a number of extra pumps that we had improvised. And at that point, we realized that we might need help. And so we initially contacted the Coast Guard to let them know our location and position and what was going on board, that basically we were taking on water. We had a number of different pumps going, and that we were in the track of this enormous weather system, and that we weren't sure, you know, how we were going to make out, and that we needed help. I want to say we were 300 miles, but the important thing was we were out of helicopter range. And so at that point, when we initially contacted the Coast Guard, they told us that there was not a whole lot they could do for us because we were out of their helicopter range. But we agreed at that point to set up a regular radio call schedule and give them our latitude and longitude and let them know what was going on board. You know, I can only imagine being on the other end of that conversation, listening to sort of the progression of, you know, a really difficult situation offshore and, you know, trying to see what more that you're able to do for the ship. And so at some point, I think the Coast Guard started trying to mobilize more resources and to see what they could do. And they contacted the Navy, and they there was an aircraft carrier, the USS America, that at the time was between us and the mainland or in a close enough position that it could hold station or divert. And so that sort of changed the playing field because then it gave the Coast Guard an option to fly out to the aircraft carrier, refuel, fly out to us, and we had sort of a middle fueling ground between us and the mainland.
The initial plan is for the Coast Guard Jayhawk helicopter to fly out and drop a pump to buy them some time.
Just to sort of set the stage a little bit, it's 3 o'clock in the morning because everything good always happens at 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, so it's dark and it's windy and stormy and, you know, greater than 100 knots of breeze and significant seas. And so our 100-foot masts are sort of swaying in the breeze, and they have to get close enough to you to be able to deploy the gear and have you get the painter or the line attached to the canister. So they were able to get close enough to drop the canister. We were able to, with a boat hook, ironically, get the painter. As soon as we had the painter fast on the ship, it parted or broke away from the canister. And so we never got that pump. So then we, you know, moved on to the evacuation efforts, which they had initially told us they were going to have to make two trips. And I think once they got there and saw the situation, it became pretty clear pretty quickly that there was only going to be one trip, because if they were to come back, then they would be looking for people in the water. Our primary concern at that point was lighting, because again, it was 3 o'clock in the morning. And so the only ambient light was the light coming out of the helicopter, but the helicopter couldn't get close. They couldn't get, you know, right on top of you or really close to you because of the 100-foot mast swaying in the breeze. So essentially, we went around, and the life preservers themselves just come with a little siloom stick. And so we went around and tried to get more definitive lighting to tie onto each person. And so we cut the flotation lights off of the MOB rings, and we gave those to people. We tied dive lights to people. By the time we were at this point, there was very little freeboard left on the ship itself, and everybody was on deck, and everybody had a harness on, and they were just strapped to the lifeline. And the ship at that point was doing, I don't know, probably 13 knots with a following wind and sea. And the plan that we developed with the pilots was one person at a time would go, and they would give us the word. And then basically the person would unclip from the ship and jump over the side. And at that point, the mothership, you know, continued on at her 13 knots. And the person was just in the water with their light on, at which point the Coast Guard would do, you know, do their end of it. And they asked about deploying a rescue swimmer to help get people into the basket, ultimately to bring them up to the helicopter. We did request that they send a swimmer down for the first person who we thought would need extra help. And then after that, we felt like the rest of us would be able to get in the basket by ourselves. And I don't know how long it was. Maybe it was half an hour between each person by the time one person unclipped and was over the side before we heard back from the pilots that they had the person safe aboard and were ready for the next one.
They would jump over the side, and then would they be gone from your vision? They
yes.
would disappear?
Yeah, they'd be gone. And again, at that point, steering and maintaining, you know, the Anna Christina was a huge amount of effort. So everybody who was left was still focused on, it's almost as though as soon as that person was over the side, they were, you know, under the hands of the Coast Guard. You know, we were then focused on the people that were left on board and keeping sort of the ship going, you know, and with each person that sort of went over the side and reassurance from the Coast Guard, another successful pickup, then I think it got easier and easier for people to actually to do it.
Can you describe that moment when it was your turn to unclip? And
just the conditions were so extreme. And even just thinking about the efforts, like what the pilots had to do to be able to do this. So they had to basically hold station next to a schooner that's moving at like 13 knots, whose masts are sort of swinging around, and then find people at 3 o'clock in the morning. And so when it came to be my turn to unclip, At that time, I just had on foul weather gear, and we were in the Gulf Stream. So the water was relatively warm, even though it was October. And I just remember after I jumped over the side, you know, it took me a minute just to sort of orient myself. And I could see the basket sort of off in the distance. And I don't know what the distance was from me to it, but it required me swimming there to get to it. And I was able to get into the basket and then sort of wave to the folks up above that I was in, and I think, you know, I'm sure they have their own protocols. Once they start lifting you up, you're still underwater because these enormous waves are crashing over your head. So I remember at the time, like having my, once I got in the basket, I had sort of closed my eyes, and it, you have to imagine sitting in something that's like the size of a shopping cart, and it would be with my eyes closed. And at times you're holding your breath because it was just water, 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 and then air, and you could breathe, and then it'd be water, 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 and then eventually got to the point where it's just air. And I opened my eyes, and there was a sign on the front of the basket that said, "Please remain seated," which at the time was just hilarious. And, you know, and after the fact, I ended up talking to the pilots, and they were explaining that generally after a rescue, people are so excited to be rescued that by the time that the basket actually gets up to the helicopter, they want it to be sort of a controlled exit. Originally, they said, you know, we were too much weight to rescue everybody, but they figured it out. They made it work. Once we were in the helicopter, they took us to the aircraft carrier, the USS America, and I actually fell asleep in the helicopter, and I was like, you know, felt super safe for the first time in days, and I had sort of forgotten sort of everything that was going on. And it really wasn't, and, you know, it took a minute, and seeing one of those "you are here" signs in the shape of an aircraft carrier to, like, bring me back and help me realize, oh, like, oh, yeah, this is what's going on. You know, between the Navy and the Coast Guard, they took really good care of us while we were, while they were refueling and getting ready for the next leg back to Elizabeth City, North Carolina, which is ultimately where we ended up.
That was Jen Irving recounting her experience being rescued by the Coast Guard during the perfect storm in 1991. Back at Coast Guard Air Station Cape Cod, Lieutenant Michael Yunes joins us. He's a Jayhawk helicopter pilot. We started our conversation asking him how they prepare for heavy weather search and rescue missions.
Well, we have a pretty robust training program here at the air station, and the Coast Guard as a whole also has other more realistic training. We have Advanced Helicopter Rescue Summer School. In the Pacific Northwest, deals with the high sea states, high surf, in those conditions. Now, a lot of times, we do get a lot of high sea states here off the Cape. So sometimes you'll have that real world scenarios right here in our backyard. We have a lot of experienced aviators who are instructor pilots, flight examiners. We spend a lot of time undergoing a lot of discussions and bringing our junior aviators up to speed on how to kind of get ready for these conditions. The other side of that is a pretty in-depth training schedule that we run every week. Our boat stations help us out a lot in that regard. So a lot of the vessels that we train on are the Coast Guard vessels, you know, the 45 and the 47-foot vessels we can hoist people to and, you know, deliver devices, and then they'll give us cover for rescue swimmer work. Within reason, you know, we have training limits that we have to maintain and adhere to. A lot of the conditions out there can get pretty, you know, challenging, especially when you're dealing with night over water work. So needless to say, we spend a good amount of time training because you never know when you're going to get the call and you're going to have to turn everything on in a search and rescue situation.
So you get a call, somebody's in distress. How quickly can you get out there?
All right, so we are kind of mandated to have what's called a B0 response within 30 minutes of the call. However, there's a lot more items that go into that. You know, we don't launch blindly into the conditions. You know, we do a lot of due diligence in checking the weather, checking the condition of the aircraft. If there are any questionable conditions, we will take the time to make sure that it's, one, can we effect a successful launch? Can we get there? Can we get back? Fuel reserves, maintenance requirements. So there's a lot that goes on within that 30-minute window. A lot of times we're pretty close to meeting that window. Other times, you know, we have to have a discussion, you know, if there's any unforeseen hazards or hazardous conditions that we need to address or mitigate or otherwise avoid. So we have the window that's expected of us, but that doesn't mean we blindly go, you know, and that's where we sit down as a team and all the key stakeholders and the key players, and we have that discussion before we agree to launch.
Talk a little bit about the teamwork that's involved in search and rescue. You know, you're piloting the helicopter. You can't see everything that's going on. So that teamwork is critical to the mission.
Yes, there's a lot. There's a lot that goes into affecting a safe and successful search and rescue mission. I know we have a lot of folks on the hangar deck who maintain these aircraft and keep them in pretty much tip-top shape. We have a lot of folks at sectors, boat stations, who kind of manage the information at the district level and kind of task us. And so we rely on them for a lot of information over the radio, you know, for search patterns or any amplifying information that we can get en route to the case. And there's a lot. It is kind of a momentous effort when you really have the strategic view of everybody's hand that takes part in this. It is very much a team effort, and it's very satisfying when everything comes together and it's all pretty seamless, and it's kind of amazing.
Why two pilots?
Safety. You know, you have the aircraft commander, you have the co-pilot, you know, or the safety pilot, and they're there to back each other up. We have a robust CRM program, crew resource management, and operational risk management program, and having two pilots is just proven that it's safer. You run a checklist, you follow protocols, and that's kind of the key to safe and effective search and rescue operations. I know I've had some cases where I have flown single pilot, you know, flying in a different airframe. However, to be fair, it's better. You feel more comfortable flying with two pilots, having another set of eyes sitting next to you, kind of backing you up and helping you out.
How did you talk about the trajectory you had? You know, did you always want to be a pilot? What was your career path? How did you end up where you are now?
As a kid, I knew I wanted to be a military aviator. Mine was a very, very long journey with a lot of twists and turns. As a young man, graduating from high school, I went to college, went to civilian flight training. You know, I paid a lot of money out of pocket, getting a lot of fixed wing ratings. And then the downturn after 9/11, you know, the aviation industry wasn't at its best. So I decided to join the military as a helicopter pilot. Started off with the Army. And did a lot of great things, you know, with the Army, flew the Black Hawk, did three tours of the Middle East. But there was a point in time when, you know, I started to settle down. I got married, had a kid, realized that, you know, I probably didn't want to continue going to the Middle East. So a lot of my friends at the time were actually leaving the Army for the Coast Guard. So I essentially followed in their footsteps and researched the program to become a Coast Guard aviator. And thank goodness, you know, I applied, got selected. And so I've been starting my Coast Guard journey for about 10 years now. Started off in New Orleans, sent to Detroit, and now I'm here in the Cape flying H-60. So I'm very, very happy to be flying this machine.
Why helicopters?
Helicopters? Well, they're awesome. They're challenging, high-performance aircraft, and they rescue people. I mean, they're very versatile. Flying airplanes are fun. You know, it's easy to go from point A to B, and I've had, you know, experiences doing that. However, when it really comes down to having the most exciting job, the most rewarding job, the most challenging job, with it's high reward. Some people consider it high risk. You know, it's very challenging, but the rewards are real, especially when you save someone's life. And that's you have to experience that. You can't just put that into words. You know, once you're there and you do it, it's an amazing experience.
So, and you have more interaction with the people you save in being in the helicopter. What is that like when, you know, you save that person, and I'm sure they're very thankful, and you get to have that interaction face-to-face with them?
Right. Yeah, it is very rewarding knowing that you save someone's life who is in distress, under duress. Mostly it's the look on their face. When you see them come up, you pull them into the helicopter, and they're just so very happy or relieved to just be safe. You know, they're going home. They get to live another day. My most rewarding experience of all was saving a young boy's life who was seizing uncontrollably, a 4-year-old guy off of a cruise ship. You know, and we pulled him up, pulled his mom up, the doctor, the equipment that was keeping him stable. And it was a very, very tight cabin. In that regard, and knowing full well that we got him, we ended up taking him to a children's hospital. And the next day he was, you know, stabilized and made a full recovery. That was very rewarding. Had a lot of search and rescue cases where a lot of folks had some unfortunate events happen to them. You hit rocks, sink the vessel, so on and so forth, and save, you know, parents, children, pets. It's very satisfying when you see kind of the looks on their faces at the end of a successful rescue.
That was Coast Guard Jayhawk helicopter pilot Lieutenant Michael Yunez. Another helicopter pilot, Lieutenant Kyle Bertoluzzi, joined us. We wanted to know how he ended up as a Coast Guard aviator.
So I always found it intriguing, very, very fascinating, and I was certain from the start, very rewarding. However, my grandfather, who was one of the bigger role models in my life, He flew helicopters in the Coast Guard for a full career, and I wanted to make sure I did it for the right reasons. So for me, I elected not to do aviation and tried to stay away from it just to make sure I did it for me and not just going, oh, you know, somebody else had a great time doing it. So what I ended up doing, graduated from the academy, no intention of going to aviation. And then after 2 years of on a boat, actually out of Woods Hole, I was on the Sanibel. I spent a lot of time getting seasick and realized you probably don't get seasick when you're in the plane. So I finally succumbed to all of his great stories and then put my name in the hat for aviation, and they accepted. And then 4 years later, now I'm here.
Why helicopters?
Actually, I found fixed wing very appealing too. I would say I probably had a bias due to my grandfather having a lot of hoisting stories out of Alaska, Bering Sea. He flew three tours up there, and I would say the proximity of the air crew to the survivors is much closer, obviously, so it's a bit more personal, and that appealed to me.
When you get the call for a search and rescue case, what kinds of information aid you in the search? It's a big ocean out there.
So it would depend strictly off of the reporting source. Was it reported by the individual? Is it an overdue vessel that maybe, you know, a family member reported, you know, this, you know, my husband was supposed to go out. This is one that I was on, and he was overdue. He was supposed to be back at 4 p.m., and he was supposed to, you know, call us when he got to the pier, and it's now 4 hours later, sunset's approaching. I'm wondering where he is. We have radio beacons that'll give you pretty much within a 3 mile accuracy via satellite of where, you know, a vessel in distress is. So it just depends on the reporting source. We have a number of different search patterns that we can execute, all based off of probabilities. So it's just a mathematical model that's provided to us oftentimes from the sectors, and they have that application on their computers. They'll type in, you know, hey, we think it's an overdue surfer, or a surfer was seen or taken offshore. It was a vessel this size that's overdue. It was a person in the water. It was a flare sighting. We're unsure of the vessel. And they can take all those variables into account, give us track spacing, so subsequent track legs, how close we should be, how close to the water we should be. And then that's all based off of current weather conditions. Pretty much anything and everything you can think of to give us a high, what we call probability of detection for whatever the search object is.
Talk about the teamwork. You know, you're in that helicopter. You're concentrating on piloting the helicopter. So talk about what the importance of the team around you.
Imperative. I'll echo pretty much everything Mike Yana has said. You'll get an opportunity. Both of you are going to fly with us this afternoon, right? So you'll get an opportunity to see the amount of trust that goes both ways between the pilot flying and the flight mech. I mean, that is, he's directing the helicopter and I'm trusting him 100%. If we lose target or lose visual with the airframe, then it's completely up to him to get us in a safe flight regime. After that, I'm taking his directions blindly at that point. That's not what we hope for. We hope to stay visual the whole time. Other than that, I'm counting on a safety pilot, whoever's sitting left seat, to be backing me up and making sure I'm staying in a safe flight regime the entire time. And then with the rescue swimmer, probably the most exciting job when he gets underneath that rotor wash and he's hanging beneath the helicopter, he's trusting the flight mech to give good conning commands to me and for me to be smooth, not develop a swing with the rescue swimmer, and to put him safely on deck in whatever sea conditions we're hoisting in.
Do you find the same thing, that the reward in saving someone is not so much in what they say to you after, but the look on their face when you pull them into that helicopter?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, sometimes it depends on the circumstances. If we're busy, you might not get a chance to see the individual, but absolutely. But I actually got a chance to experience that as well on the cutter. And so I know our surface folks, they also get a chance to, you know, reach out and touch these individuals and see the looks on their face. And that is, it's pretty tough to beat. Yep.
And what's been your most memorable moment?
Most probably it is flying over Houston the week after the storms, when the flooding was still prevalent. I went up as a backup crew, relieving some of our guys that did a very high number of hoists and a lot of rescues. And essentially, we were identifying landing zones for a lot of the logistics and relief efforts. So we were flying over land and looking at our chart and seeing, oh, you know, we should be able to see land to the horizon right now. And it was water with a few tall trees sticking out of the water. And that was about it. So that was probably the most memorable that I've had in my 2 years here.
That was Pilot Lieutenant Kyle Bertoluzzi. The next stop on our visit to Coast Guard Air Station Cape Cod is the Rescue Swimmer Hangar. We're greeted with an artist's rendition of a rescue swimmer outfitted in goggles, snorkel, and fins, straddling a great white shark. Inside the hangar is a more serious reminder of why rescue swimmers are stationed on Cape Cod. Life jackets and immersion suits adorn a wall. Each have handwritten messages on them and have been signed by those who were saved at sea by the rescue swimmers and flight crews. One suit reads, "Sea Star, south of Martha's Vineyard, boat went down, stem first. Huge thank you to you guys. You killed it." While we were getting outfitted for the flight, senior rescue swimmer Rashid Arnick joins us. We ask him about the swim school and the percentage of people who graduate.
Right now, I believe we have a 79% failure rate out of school. And basically, it's pretty grueling. A lot of swimming, a lot of land PT or working out. And it's extremely mental. It's an 80% mental issue, but that 20% is still pretty grueling. Mental is just waking up the next morning and, yeah, I'm going to do this. Or you hit that brick wall and you say, well, I have no choice. I have to keep going, and being able to go through it. If you hit that brick wall and you can't seem to break through it, then out in the middle of the night in the heavy surf trying to rescue somebody and you hit a wall, then it's your life and possibly the people you're rescuing's lives on the line.
Talk about that weather conditions. Sometimes when you're out there, you're at night, so it's dark, and the seas can be really big, and it's not easy to catch your breath or breathe in those kind of conditions, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, depending on the sea state, you'll have rolling seas, you'll have crashing seas, and you can have flat calm generally, but the bigger the sea state, the bigger the rollers, yeah, sometimes it can be harder to catch your breath. We train specifically to be able to survive in heavy seas for 30 minutes. We train underwater work where we hold our breath and we try and relax ourselves and catch our breath, you know, when we can. So we try and train for that situation. Obviously, nothing is exactly the same and nothing goes as planned, but we do our best.
You talk about this being mental. It's mental and physical. And I'm thinking, all right, you're trained to be calm in these crazy weather conditions, but the person you're rescuing is probably not so calm and can be fighting you rather than helping you help rescue them.
Right. Yeah, sometimes, yeah, you get a panic survivor. You always hope that they're not, but, you know, when somebody's in an emergent situation, you know, their mind's going to take over. We do train for that. We train for people panicking and freaking out and grabbing onto us and trying to use us as a life float. We have different procedures that we train that we can get them flipped around off of us and in control. So we're still holding on to them, but they're not going to drag us under, and then we can get them to safety.
Rashid then gives us a glimpse of the rescue swimmer workout area. It looks like a typical gym until we see enormous tractor tires that swimmers must lift and flip, and barbells with weights that wouldn't be out of place at a weightlifting championship. When not in the pool, this is where the swimmers do their daily two-hour workouts. We head over to a maintenance hangar and meet flight mechanic Ben Jilka, who is in the midst of overseeing work on the rotor heads of a Jayhawk helicopter. We ask him about the duties of a Coast Guard flight mechanic.
We fly them and we fix them. Other services, they have fixers and flyers. So being in the operational world and the maintenance world and combining that into one thing takes time and takes effort. So in the shop, like, we are focused on fixing the aircraft, making sure they're good to fly. As we move up in rank, I've kind of moved into a role where I'm a flight examiner and sometimes cover the shop as well as turn wrenches. So as you move up, you just get more experience and teach all the younger guys keep the planes flying. Once we put on our dry suits, go fly. That's now we're thinking about SAR cases, hoisting, how to get somebody on or off of a boat that we need to, or out of big waves. So you're just, one is like more like emergency response. One is we need to keep this aircraft safe and is it good to go fly.
So what's your biggest challenge?
Time. Time to do everything and just being able to keep up on all the different things. With Coast Guard versus the other services, we have two aviation maintenance rates, and the other services have 6, 7, 8 that are, so they're all responsible for one system where we're responsible for the whole aircraft. So being up on all the knowledge just takes a lot more time.
What kinds of stress do the helicopters undergo, and what does it take to keep them operationally safe?
So all of our aircraft have about double the amount of our hours that the other services will get rid of them at. We send them in for an overhaul. I think it's every 4 or 5 years, and they replace a lot of the major structural components that are just because it's an old aircraft. So we have to be a lot more detailed to make sure that, like, the things that other services don't have to worry about, like material fatigue and stuff like that, cracks, we are worrying about and having to do more detailed inspections, making sure that we don't have the cracks, just because I think all of our aircraft are over 12,000 hours, and I think the Army gets rid of them at 6,000. So.
Difference. So you're every day going over these.
Our maintenance is calendar and hourly based, so pops up each month or pops up based on how many hours we've flown. And our big inspections are like 2, 4, 8, and 1,200 hour inspections that we'll do. And that's just different systems get torn down to different levels and looked at.
As the technology changes, I'm sure you're constantly having to keep up on new techniques and ways of doing things.
Not so much. No, I think these aircraft are from like late 60s. I want to say is when they were built. Maybe early. We might have one from like the early 90s, but it's an older airframe, and the technology just really it's been the same for 30, 40 years. The only thing that happened, I think it's like 2012, we did a T-model like avionics upgrade in the cockpit. So it went from like all the old like standard plane gauges you'd see from World War II to the glass cockpit computer screen style. But in terms of how the plane works, that hasn't changed.
So how did you get this particular route, this particular job?
I was an engineering student. I previously worked in machine shops and other stuff like that, so rolling into aviation maintenance was I knew I wanted to fly and work on planes, and that's exactly what I got to do. So
our flight crew today consists of two pilots, Lieutenant Michael Yunez and Lieutenant Kyle Bertoluzzi, flight mechanic Ben Jilka, and rescue swimmer Reese Williams. The pilots and flight mechanics are outfitted in helmets and flight suits. Their gear also includes a safety harness that doubles as a PFD and includes a number of survival items such as flares and EPIRB and emergency oxygen in case they need to exit the helicopter underwater. The rescue swimmer is outfitted in a dry suit, gloves, snorkel, mask, and fins. His helmet is equipped with a radio earpiece and microphone, so once he's in the water, he can remain in communication with the flight crew. As we head out of the hangar, the Jayhawk HH-60 is just returning from another flight. The noise is deafening, and we are advised to lower our helmet visors as protection from dust and debris that could be kicked up by the spinning rotors. After a safety briefing on how to exit the aircraft in case of an emergency, we're airborne and heading south from Air Station Cape Cod. Within a few minutes, we're over Vineyard Sound. We fly west past the iconic Nopska Lighthouse and over Woods Hole. The Coast Guard 45 utility boat has left the dock in Woods Hole to assist with today's training operations. On board the 45 are WCAI's Brian Morris and Liz Lerner. The helicopter, referred to as 6026, makes radio contact with the 45-foot Coast Guard vessel, referred to as the 717.
6026, 6026, 717, channel 127.
717 from the 26, go ahead.
Roger, it's going to be a little more south before we're going to be ready. If you want to go ahead and do the vessel brief, we can do that.
Roger, that sounds good. Right now we're showing winds out of the west, so we're looking for a course of around 350 to 360. Speed, we generally go about 5 knots over whatever's comfortable for these conditions underway. Radar, once we get overhead, we'll secure our radar. We ask that you do the same as Eleanor Propia Lighting for today. Lower stow, secure any antennas, booms, flagstaff, frigging, loose gear, anything getting caught up in the rotor wash. For evolutions today, we're going to start off with a trail line deployment, our rescue swimmer to your well deck. He's going to go ahead and embark and kind of assist you guys a little bit. And then we're going to go ahead and move into some baskets underway with and without trail line, followed by DIW baskets. After which, we'll have the rescue swimmer jump into the water for some swimmer work. When we get the device down, please don't forget to discharge static electricity. If you have to disconnect the hook, please do not connect it to the vessel. And if we have to do a normal abort evolution, we'll go easy back and left. And an emergency flyaway will be forward and left. We currently have
seven
souls on board. How many do you have?
26, 717. We have 0 9er people on board.
Roger that. We kindly ask that when we're doing trail line deliveries with the basket, once you see the basket fall below the wheel, just kind of You have a good job on that line to assist in getting it on board the vessel. Do you have any questions at all for this brief?
T6717, no, we're good. We're in a good position here. We're going to move some crews around. We might have some people outside taking video or pictures. We'll have one of the aviation guys out there as well, our two crew members.
The flight mechanic then alerts the pilots that he and the rescue swimmer are ready to begin.
I got the door open. We're ready for approach, sir.
Okay, Roger that. All right, ladies, we've completed our approach to the hover checklist. We're now going to be making our approach to the water. We're going to initial level out to 50 feet, and then we'll be anywhere from 30 to 35 feet working with the boat. Just for your awareness here, Reese, the temperature outside right now is 1 degree centigrade, so please keep us apprised if it gets a little chilly.
With the helicopter in position over the Coast Guard 45, a trail line is sent down. While the trail line is being received, the rescue swimmer gets into position at the open helicopter door, his harness clipped onto the hoist. On the 45, the crew explains circumstances when this scenario might be necessary.
For this, like, say there's a swimmer, we need to get to an area and they didn't want to deploy it from the helicopter directly, he can come down onto our boat. And or say if that's, there's a lot more EMTs, the swimmers are EMTs, we don't have a lot of EMTs at our unit. Say we need an EMT on our boat, this is the quickest way to get one on there. He can get lowered down. And say we're working on somebody down in the survivor's compartment right now. You can see helicopters right there, they're pulling them. And boom. Oh, there we go. Pull hard. He's good.
The flight mechanic is also positioned by the open door, operating the hoist and calling out instructions to the pilot as the swimmer is lowered down to the waiting Coast Guard 45.
Swimmer's on the way down. Swimmer's halfway down. You gotta come forward and right 10.
You got it.
Right 5. Easy right. Hold. Swimmer's on deck.
The flight mechanic continues to be the eyes for the pilot as the trail line and hoist come back aboard the helicopter.
We're disconnecting from the trail line. We're disconnecting from the hook. I have ready for pickup signal. Hook is on the way up. Trail line still on deck. Easy back and left.
You have mass. You are clear back and left.
Trail line still on deck. Hook's almost at the cabin. Hook's at the cabin. Next trail line from the hook. Trail line's disconnected. Retreating trail line.
After each maneuver, the flight team does a quick debrief and establishes radio contact with the rescue swimmer.
Trail line's in the cabin. Hoist complete.
Awesome. Anything from me, Ben?
No, sir. Went smoothly.
All right. Kerr, you did great. Well done. Let's see if I can reach Reese on the radio.
Rescue
swimmer from the 2-6, I got you 5x5, homie. Roger, thank you much appreciated. Alright, you guys ready for some basket action?
Oh yeah, sir.
The crew then prepares for a series of exercises with the basket. It's stainless steel and large enough for one person to sit inside with bent knees. The crew deploys and retrieves the basket from the Coast Guard vessel a number of times at different angles and approaches, simulating the different scenarios that could happen in an actual rescue mission. The rescue swimmer has been waiting on the deck of the Coast Guard 45. As we wrap up the basket maneuvers and prepare for him to enter the water, Coast Guard 45 checks in.
Be advised, we have a couple of people down here that are starting to get a little queasy. Let's know what else you plan on doing.
After that, that pretty much finishes up the boat work for us. We just need to move into some swimmer work. We need to do a minimum of 4 swimmer deployments, so hopefully that won't take too long. Are you guys able to perhaps stay on station for a little while longer?
2-6-7-1-7, yeah, roger that. We can get a bow to the forces and we can stay here for as long as you need.
Very well, that is greatly appreciated. If you want to pass word to our swimmer, he's free to disembark. Ooh, they're getting some rollers now.
Yeah.
There we go. Get it, Reese. Wonder if somebody's gonna upchuck over the side. Oh man, people getting sick. I'm getting sick. All right, on that boat right now. Front row. Hey man, Benji, you got the good hand dealt to you.
that's for sure.
Yeah,
there's a reason I went aviation.
Yeah,
I wouldn't have to do this.
The temperature this day is 1 degree Celsius, or 33.8 degrees Fahrenheit. The wind is Beaufort, force 4, approximately 18 miles per hour, and there are 3-foot seas in Vineyard Sound. Once the swimmer is in the water and the Coast Guard vessel standing by, the flight crew initiates a series of swimmer operations, starting with the flight mechanic tossing out a mannequin or dummy to simulate a civilian in the water. Safety is always a priority, whether training or on an actual SARS mission. Before each maneuver, a rescue checklist, briefing, and risk analysis is conducted.
Somebody's in the water.
Okay.
28 feet, you're clear back and left.
Niner.
All right, swimmer's at the dummy.
Okay.
He's calling for the basket.
You got it, rescue for part two.
Roger, rescue racing.
Moving into swimmer ops, so hazard analysis will be the standard for swimmer ops. This will be a basket recovery of the simulated survivor, followed by more than likely a bear hook. Present heading, present altitude. Any questions?
No questions. The basket's almost rigged.
All right. Take your time. You let me know. Race complete.
Roger. Rescue checklist complete. Ready for basket recovery of dummy from the water.
All right. Begin the hoist.
Roger. Target strike. Bring basket outside the cabin door.
After the dummy is returned to the helicopter via the basket, the helicopter hovers over the rescue swimmer so he can attach himself to the hoist and return to the helicopter.
Easy right. Hold. Swimmer's at the hook. Forward five. Easy right. Hold. Try to take load. Swimmer's clear of the water, hold position.
Nice.
I was just waiting on that wave. Swimmer's just below the cabin. Bring swimmer up to the cabin. Swimmer's in the cabin. Hoist complete.
The next maneuver is one that many rescue swimmers find the most exhilarating, jumping from the helicopter directly into the water. It's called the free fall. In order to execute a free fall, the water depth needs to be at least 12 feet. Because Vineyard Sound can vary greatly in depth, the Hilo crew first checks in with the Coast Guard vessel.
And for the 717 from the 26, request a depth check from this position, if able.
26 for the 717, depth over here is about 17 feet.
Thank you very much.
17 feet, we're good.
Nice.
Before they begin the maneuver, the pilot checks in on the swimmer, who's been in the water for at least 10 minutes now.
Is Reese okay?
Yeah, he's flying good.
Okay. As analysis, we'll just be hawking altitude as we come down low over the water. Only change there is to be a free fall. Deployment of the rescue swimmer to the simulated survivor, present heading, present altitude. Any questions?
No questions. Ready for free fall deployment of the SOAR.
Yeah, check swimmer.
Swimmer's ready.
You can copy in and then copy down when you're in a happy position.
Roger. I think this is good, sir. We can easy down.
Okay.
Easy down.
19, 18, 16, 15. You're below 15.
Easy down.
And there's 11 feet. You can deploy a swimmer.
Roger. Swimmer's away. Swimmer's in the water. Swimmer's okay. Up back and left, 25.
You got it.
Swimmer's making his way out to the dummy.
Inside. He goes, he's command.
Rad out 3 set, 28 feet, pilot compile.
Thank you.
And hoist, please.
The next maneuver is a simulated recovery of swimmer and survivor from the water. The flight mechanic cons the pilot as the sling is lowered on the hoist to the rescue swimmer. Once the swimmer has the sling, the flight mechanic ensures there's no tension on the hoist as the swimmer works to secure the dummy in the sling. In these maneuvers, the flight mechanic choreographs an intricate dance in real time between the helicopter and swimmer, taking into consideration wind, waves, and current.
Swimmer's working with the sling. A little bit in the area right now, but he's not far out right now, sir.
Okay.
Swimmer's, I'm just going to let him drift out a little bit, though. So easy back and left.
You are clear back and left.
Easy back and left.
Got him inside.
Roger. Hold position. Things around the dummy.
Whenever possible, the crew tries to minimize the effort and danger to the swimmer. In this scenario, the sling is lowered to the swimmer and the Gila moves off slightly.
This method is nice because it allows him to work in the water and get a survivor situated without getting beat up by our rotor wash, which is right below us right now. But just the pilot can see him and kind of hold with him with the currents, and then I can manage the cable with the waves and everything.
The crew conducts several more swimmer operations before calling the rescue operations training complete. Once the cabin is secure and the rescue swimmer and flight mechanic have returned to their seats, the pilots crank on the heat and rescue swimmer Reese Williams holds his numb fingers up to the heat outlets. Before returning to the air station, pilot Yunez practices flying in reduced visibility by donning a view-limiting device, or VLD. The device simulates restricted visibility conditions such as rain or fog, and without visual cues, Lieutenant Yunez is obligated to fly solely off the aircraft instruments. Once we're back on the tarmac at Air Station Cape Cod, the helicopter is refueled, and the crew ensures all equipment and supplies are ready for the next training flight or search and rescue call. Even rescue swimmer Reese Williams, still in his dry suit, helps with this evolution. When he's finished, he meets us back in the rescue swimmer hangar.
Tell me about the training you received to become a rescue swimmer and how tough it is. I heard there's like a 70-something percent failure rate.
Yes. So the training's in Elizabeth City, North Carolina. And, yeah, it was pretty hard. I grew up swimming, actually. So my dad, my parents, my dad and my mom got me into swimming at, like, the age 5. So, and I competed all the way to, like, my freshman year of high school. So that's, like, a good, like, 10 years of, like, competitive swimming. And on one of the situations, I was, like, one of the most, like, tired I've ever been, like, in my life compared to, like, the competitive swimming. An example is the basket test. They put all of your skills together during this one test, and you have to tow an instructor. This instructor, he happened to be 220 pounds, all muscle, like, really dense in the water, and you have to put him in a buddy tow, basically, to complete this test. And I failed it twice, and I ended up passing it, like, on my third try. And that was hands down, like, the most tired I've ever been, again, like, in my life. The training overall is hard. And I think the hardest part is, like, or one of the main parts is that a lot of people don't know what to expect coming into school. And they kind of get, like, blindsided by the workouts, by the things that you have to do in and out of the pool. And, yeah, it was a good experience. And it's 6 months long as well, so, yeah.
And you have to stay in shape. And I notice you guys here have this gym that you're working out every day, right?
Yes, every day, yeah. It's part of our work schedule. We have at least 2 hours to work out every day. And then we have 2 pool days throughout the week. And so the Coast Guard manual says you have to be able to withstand 30 minutes in outside in heavy seas.
All right, so today you jumped out of that, or jumped out somewhat and was loaded down out of that helicopter several times. What is that like in temperatures like this?
Well, first of all, it's fun. It's very fun. Like I told you earlier, like, the worst part is just sitting in the helicopter door, you know, waiting to go out. That's, like, the coldest part. Once you get inside the water, you're fine. I'm actually warmer inside the water than I am inside the door. I mean, while you're waiting in there, like, your feet go numb, your hands go numb. It kind of sucks. But, yeah, once you're inside the water, it's, like, not that bad at all.
Why did you want to be a rescue swimmer?
It started probably in high school. Honestly, the movie The Guardian helped a little bit, probably just because of my swimming background. And I've always felt a need to help people out in a certain way that I couldn't really explain as a younger kid. If I could use my athletic ability and swim ability to do that, then that's what I want to do. 4 years into the Coast Guard now, you see what it takes to be able to do this job. And I've been able to see, just based on, like, the rest of the guys that I work with some of the cases that they've had, what it takes to complete those cases. And so
my reasons for joining were kind of like more personal. Now, like I see like the bigger picture. Now that I'm in at like 22 years old, I see the bigger picture and I see like how it could actually help people out in the fleet, out in the rate. Yeah, it's exciting. It's just something I've always wanted to do.
Now, something I learned today was that the high frequency of the helicopter actually attracts the sharks.
Yeah, it's either the high or the low frequency, but basically that sound that the rotor blades make, the sharks can hear it underwater. And I've heard stories also that they like to splash around in the rotor wash. They like to play around in like the wind and the rotor wash. So, I mean,
does it make you nervous?
It does. Yeah, I don't watch Shark Week. I try not to. There's all those apps, you know, that show sharks their location. I mean, I don't have that on my phone. I just try to like not think about it at all. But we know they're here. But I mean, I guess the best strategy is to just not think about it at all. You know, ignorance is bliss, I guess.
What's your biggest challenge?
Biggest challenge probably was just all of the knowledge that they kind of throw at you after ASTA school, the 6-month training program. And not that it's, you know, hard to understand, but there's just a lot to learn. And I am 4 months qualified, and I graduated the program a year ago. But that's not where it ends. There's so much you can learn about the job, about the Coast Guard in general. Maybe it's not my biggest challenge, but for me, I plan on doing this until I retire, so for 20 more years. And so for me, I just want to learn as much as I can about the job and how I could help people out in the best way possible. So for me, it's going to be learning everything that I can. I'm going to be a sponge and soak up like as much information as possible.
Well, good luck.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Summer brings more people out on the water. This means a busy season for the Coast Guard. Lieutenant Mike Yunez.
You know, the Memorial Day to Labor Day season is kind of like our bread and butter. It is nonstop. Now, obviously, recreation goes up in the summertime, so you'll have a lot of calls associated with those types of boaters. But others are industry, you know, fishing industry, you know, vessels in distress or medevacs. It's the amount of calls that come in is just at times unbelievable, you know, because we'll get launched on a SAR case, go see to it, and either in the middle of that SAR case or coming back from it, we'll get diverted for another SAR case. So the demand can be high at times.
Sometimes the Coast Guard is called out because small boats or kayaks are seen adrift without occupants. The Coast Guard assumes there is someone missing from the vessels until they are alerted otherwise. Oftentimes, it's simply a case of a small boat not being made fast to shore or not hauled up past the high tide rack line. We asked Lieutenant Bertoluzzi what message he'd like to give people who spend time on the water.
Recreationally, I think, you know, when you have somebody operating for pleasure, vice operating for their livelihood, and then the frequency of that on Cape Cod being people that are only operating recreational vessels in the summer for a few weeks out of the year, they're just not as proficient. Not an error on the individual, but just realize that when you're in a vessel and things start going wrong, you can't just pull over on the side of the road and everything's okay. If you start sinking, that's going to be problematic. So planning is probably the biggest one. Know the weather, look at the weather every time you go out, and then from there, make sure your safety gear's in place. A lot of people probably see that as a hurdle to overcome, but it absolutely is imperative, you know, if stuff goes sideways.
If things do go sideways, we are fortunate to have the Coast Guard boat and air crews at the ready to help. We have videos and photos from our trip, along with links to more information about Air Station Cape Cod at our website, capeandislands.org. Thanks to Petty Officer Nicole Grohl for coordinating our visit. Special thanks to our flight crew, Lieutenant Kyle Bertoluzzi and Lieutenant Michael Yunez, flight mechanic Ben Jilka, and rescue swimmers Reese Williams and Rashid Arnick for taking the time to share their stories and take us flying. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.